Okay, then let's look at Gomorrah. So firstly, a little bit of introduction to Gomorrah itself. Now, some of you have learned Gomorrah for a long time, some of you haven't, some of you learned a lot, some of you learned a little. So there will be things we do that for some will be very, very basic, and we'll move through it, and for some of you there'll be things that we'll have to clarify and make sure that you know. But in terms of what Gomorrah is, there are two different mitzvahs. When it comes to the mitzvah of learning Torah, there are two different mitzvahs. The one is in Shema, which is V'shinantim Levonecho, and the Gemara says, Ad sheyehei mechudodim Levonecho, you need to know the Torah, you need to study the Torah until it's absolutely clear to you. That's called the mitzvah of Yediyas HaTorah. You're supposed to know the Torah. And then there's another mitzvah, V'gisa bo yomam v'layla, even if you know the Torah, you're meant to study the Torah. So these are two different things, Yediyas HaTorah and Limud HaTorah, knowledge of the Torah and study of the Torah. Why this is important is, apart from the information of the Torah, there is a separate mitzvah to engage deeply in the study of Torah. Even assuming you knew the whole of Shas backwards and inside out, you still need to do what we're doing tonight. And what we're doing tonight is not the Yediyas HaTorah piece at all. It's not a matter of gaining more knowledge and information. That's not the piece that we're going to be involved in this year. We're going to be involved much more in the piece around Limud Torah. Why the mitzvah to study Torah? Why is that so important? And I might have mentioned in the email that I sent around that with no scientific evidence, just purely intuition, but a lot of people when I've shared it with them, agree with it, is that the reason for the inordinate number of the Nobel Prizes that Jews win, it's not because of any superiority, it's not because we're brighter or more brilliant. In my view, it's centuries of learning Gomorrah that has programmed the mind so that even people who haven't learned for a couple of generations, their mind is still programmed. Hart, this is your area, I guess, but the plasticity of the mind could theoretically develop and change over centuries of it being used in a particular way. Yes. But that makes sense. And that over centuries and centuries, this is our way of thinking has been developed, and the neurological passageways of our minds are different from others. We think differently. And the reason we think differently is not because we're superior. The reason we think differently is from the study of Gomorrah. And when I shared this once at a Jewish day school, not in the United States, a very large Jewish day school, and I shared it with the administration of the school, which was mainly non-Jewish. Part of it were Jewish. There were some rabbis there, but there were also non-Jewish staff who were there. And I learned some Gomorrah with them and told them why I thought this was the case. And the non-Jewish principal got up and he said, what right have we had, because they don't teach Gomorrah at that school, what right have we had to deprive Jewish children of what is rightfully theirs? How could we be teaching them everything else except the one thing that makes them unique and gives them an edge? So Gomorrah is the gift that the Ribbono Shel Olam has given us and the Jewish people has developed over the period of years to think God's way, to think the way God thinks, so to say. But to do that, you've got to think. This is not about the Daf Yomi. Daf Yomi has done some wonderful things for society, and people get together and they learn all over the world, and it's a wonderful thing. But it does nothing for the mind. It doesn't train the mind in any way. How can you possibly go through a page of Gomorrah in an hour and it affects the neurological passageways of your mind? No way, it's not going to happen. And you can do it for 20 years and it's not going to happen. But learning Gomorrah, allowing yourself to engage with Gomorrah seriously, it doesn't matter what the topic is. That's what I said to you in the email. It doesn't matter what the topic is. I've deliberately chosen a topic that is not all that practical. It's not about anything practical. It's about a way of thinking. It's about the way you analyze. It's about the way you extrapolate. It's about the way you link things together. Those are some of the skills that we're going to be looking at. And the Gomorrah is in nature. This is rather important to appreciate as we go through. The Gomorrah is not about, let me put it this way. There are two realities that exist side by side. I'm sure there are many more. But for our purposes of our conversation, there are two realities that sit side by side. The one is the reality you live in. You look around and you see that's one reality. There is another reality, which is a model, if you can think of it that way, kind of almost a virtual reality, of a system of concepts and their relationships with each other. That's a whole world. Now, how these two worlds interact, that's halakha. Halakha deals with the interaction. Gemara is the world of concepts and relationships. The physical world, science and chemistry and our day-to-day life, that's the world of material interactions. Those are two different worlds. How they interact, that's the Shulchan Aruch. That's where the mitzvahs come in, how they interact. But in this shir, we're not going to be dealing with the physical world much. We are, as you'll see, but we're going to be dealing with it very conceptually. And we're not going to be dealing with the interaction between the interface between these two worlds as much as dealing in the conceptual world alone. So the Gemara, Rabbi Yoshe Ben Soloveitchik, explains this very beautifully in Ish Halacha. The Gemara is, it's a conceptual world. So when the Gemara talks about an ox, it's not the ox you see on the farms. It's a concept. It doesn't matter if you've never seen a real ox or you ever will see a real ox. An ox is a concept. And it talks about an ox gored a cow. It's not a cow. It's a pshor and it's a para. These are concepts. And he gores the power, and now there's certain outcomes. You're dealing with ideas. So in the Gemara that we'll be learning, we'll be dealing with ideas and how they relate to each other. From that, you extrapolate principles, and those principles inform and govern your life. It's not the concepts themselves, it's the way the concepts interact and engage. From that, we'll extrapolate principles. The principles inform life. That's what Gemara is. And that's why when some of you asked about women attending and so on, I said the first ones will be useful for women because we're just beginning to get into it. Later on, generally women are not that excited about something that is purely conceptual and seems to have no practical relevance at all. Sometimes women find that difficult to relate to. What's the point? What are you going on? It's like pure maths. It's like pure music. You don't sit and study music and say, what's the practical relevance of this? If you ask that question, you don't know music. If you're studying maths and you also say, but the fact is, yes, you can develop principles from music and from maths that are very enlightening in understanding the world, but the subject itself doesn't. The next thing that's important is you're not going to master it. This is not something that you're ever really going to learn in the sense of knowing it and mastering it. It doesn't happen. This is the only study that cannot be mastered. But not only that, that's not what makes it so unique, that it cannot be mastered. It masters you. That's what's unique about this study. You've got to allow it to master you. And here we've got to be really interesting and we've got to be really careful in the sense that modern orthodoxy is a funny animal. Because if you think about it, modern orthodoxy started when?
Shimshon 200 years ago.
Maybe you want to say Shimshon Rafael Hirsch 200 years ago. That's already pushing it. But even if, and what was there before then? What is this Yiddishkeit that started 200 years ago? What does that mean? I know of religions that started, 2,000 years ago, whenever. When a religion starts all of a sudden, what does it mean? Modern orthodoxy started 200 years ago. And before that? Was there not modernity before that? Of course there was. There's always modernity. So where were the modern orthodox people? No, they just appeared later on. Where? From? What? So modern orthodoxy altogether is an interesting animal. What we've got to be very careful is understanding what it means and what it doesn't mean, what it can mean and what it can't mean. Modern orthodoxy should mean that we apply the Torah to modernity. And we've got to be doing that all the time. What we've got to be careful of, and modern orthodoxy is doing a lot of this, is that we don't adapt the Torah to modernity. When you adapt the Torah to modernity, you're reform. You're not modern orthodox. It doesn't matter whether you keep Shabbos or you keep Kashrus, you go to Yeshiva. It doesn't make a difference. If you're adapting the Torah to modernity, that's called reform. That's what it's called. And we shouldn't give it other names. It is reform. There's no such thing as conservative and... There's orthodoxy and non-orthodoxy. You're either keeping the Torah or you're not. And keeping the Torah doesn't just mean doing the mitzvahs. Keeping the Torah means you don't adapt the Torah to modernity. You adapt modernity to the Torah. You apply the Torah to modernity, and that's a very different thing. So you'll see as we'll go through, we'll actually be exploring, right? In the very first piece of Gemara we'll be learning, we'll explore some of those limits. And when do you adapt? When do you apply? What happens when the Gemara says something that's just scientifically not correct? What do we do with that? Where does that fit? How do we deal with that? We'll hit that very early on. The other thing that's important to know is there's a tendency today, which is wonderful in some ways, is to make the Gemara easier to understand. So starting with Art Scroll and lots of things since then that are being done, and the way Torah is being taught and Gemara is being taught, is to make it easier to understand. The reason Gemara is hard to understand is not because it's hard. The reason Gemara is hard to understand is because our minds aren't trained that way. So what are we doing when we make Gemara easier to understand? We're adapting Gemara to the way we're trained to think. We're adapting Gemara to secular thinking. Ah, now I get it. Now you explain it to me. It's all linear. It's clear. This and then that leads to that. And this is how you do it. It's all very clear and neat and tidy. We've taken the Gemara. We've restructured it to fit into Western thinking. And now, as Westerners, we say, now I get it. Now it's easy. But when I was in yeshiva, and they were explaining, I couldn't get what was going on. So on the one hand, it's very great that all these things are happening because it does make it easy and it brings people a lot more people into the learning of Gemara. But what it doesn't do is it does nothing for the mind. It gives you information, it enables you to learn the pages, but if you're adapting Gemara to your mind, then it's not changing your mind, it's not developing your mind. So in this year, we're not going to be doing that. We're not going to be re-dishing the Gemara up in such a way that it's easy for the Western mind to understand it. We're going to get into the Gemara's mind, and we're going to allow our Western minds to take a back seat and just explore in the way the Gemara wants us to think and see what happens. So that's quite important as we move that. You'll see that the system, you'll see right away as we start, Gemara works with hyperlinks and it works with tags. To me, if the Google people didn't get their ideas from Gemara, I don't know how they figured it out. It was brilliant to them. Because for a student of Gemara, you look at the Google system of filing and tagging and then dealing with information, you say, yeah, of course, that's how we learned at Cheder. That's how we've been doing things for 2,000 years. That's how we organize information. It's all, you know, how your emails are in Google. Everything's kind of in one big barrel. And you search with search words, and it pulls out what you need, and you tag, and it pulls out what you need, instead of actually putting it away in boxes. So the Western mind likes to put things away in boxes, and you know where each box is. So if you need a file, you'll go to the right cabinet, then you'll go to the right filing. And Google tells you, no, you don't need to do it that way. So just dump it all in one place, and you can pull it out through searches and through tags. That's how the Gemara works. It's a dump of information and a dump of ideas and of concepts. Now, there is some philosophy to the juxtaposition, and we'll look at that from time to time. But there's a lot of it that isn't really where you want. And the Torah itself works like that. We'll have a look at that. Just before we do, look at the structure of Shas. Shas are the six sections of Gemara. So if we do look at it in terms of a kind of a filing system, although we cross these files all the time, they're not neatly filed. Nothing really belongs in one file. They all belong all over the place. But the first one is called Zraim. Zraim means seeds, and it deals with all the agricultural laws. So the first one is halachic definition, because in halacha, what's important, the crucial thing is to define things correctly, to define the concept correctly. Once you've defined it, the halachot are easy. You've got to decide, is somebody a man or a woman? Once you know what they are, there are a lot of halachot. If they're a man, a whole lot of halachot. If they're a woman, a whole lot of... You don't have to have a whole argument about should a woman be doing this and should a... You're a man or you're a woman. You're a Jew or you're a Gentile. You're a slave or you're a free person. Something is treif or something is kosher. You need to be able to define the object, and then the halachot flow from that very easily. But the real innovation is in choosing where to classify. And that's what we do a lot in Gemara. So if you look at the systems of classification in Zraim, we're dealing with objects, with things whose classification results from, and the halachot result from nature. They exist because of nature. So that's fruit and trees and everything that goes with that. Nature produces them. Later on, we've got mamonot, we've got nezikin. Nezikin is one of the six sections of Shas, and that deals with situations that arise out of trade. They weren't there before. They're not there naturally. They're the result of trade. In between that, we've got two others. We've got moed. Moed is situations that arouse due to time. So it's nature, but not nature of the world. It's nature of the universe. This is now the sun and the moon and all those other things are impacting it. Zraim is just earth. Things that have been situations created by the nature of earth. Moed is things that are created by the nature of the universe. Nashim, what is the situation of Nashim? Nashim deals with women, in other words, relationships, marriage, inheritance to some degree, things that flow from relationship, but it's called Nashim. Is a woman a product of nature or a product of the big wide universe or a product of trade? Well, she's a product of nature to start with, isn't that so? So the fact is she's born a woman, so she's a product of nature. Her cycles are impacted by the moon and the universe. So she's a product of the universe. And she becomes a wife as a result of a transaction. So a woman, Nashim, fits there in the middle. Nashim is one of the intersections where you've got some Nizikin and you've got some Moed and you've got some elements of Zeroim. And then we've got... after Zroim, Nashim, Zroim, Moed, Nashim, Nezikim, then we have got Kodshim, which deals with sacrifices, temple service, things that are created, halakhic situations created by God, and then Taharot. Taharot is actually, that's Tumah and Taharot, kind of almost includes all of them. You need a human being for that, you need interaction, you need God, because without the laws of Tumah there wouldn't be such a concept. You need nature, you need transactions, you need everything. Tumas and Taharos is everything. So those are the different areas. We're learning Bechorot, and the reason we're learning Bechorot is, firstly, because that's what I'm learning at the moment, and secondly, because Bechorot is fascinating. It crosses, it really intersects a lot of these areas. So we'll see what the din of a Bechor is. But a Bechor, we have to give a Bechor to a Kohen, isn't that so? You've got to give the Bechor, we're talking the time of the temple, you give a Bechor to the Kohen. Is that a transaction or is that, what is that? First, you're dealing with an animal. Isn't that so? You're dealing with Bechor, you're dealing with your goat or your lamb or your cow. So you're dealing with an animal. So that's nature. Who do you give it to? But you have to give it along, you have to give it to the Kohen. That's a transaction. What does the Kohen have to do with it? Well, he has to bring it to the temple and it has to be slaughtered, it has to be shefted in the temple. That's Kodshim. And to some degree it's considered like a korban. So the Bechor involves all the areas of the Torah. It's an unbelievable intersection point. And that makes it a bit complex, but we'll do it very slowly, so we'll get into it regularly. So what we're going to start with is the Torah, the Chumash, that deals with Bechor. So if you've got a Chumash, then I'll tell you exactly where it is. But we've also got some printouts. I've probably got nowhere near enough. But if you can pass them around, and some of you will share, and I'll send them to you, and you can print them out at home, those of you who don't have. Here we are. Yeah, if a couple of you can share, then it's easier, and I can send out. I'll send out the copies later on. So if you look at that first page of the handout, you'll see there are psukim in Shemot, in Bamidbar and in Bamidbar. Those are the areas, but in four different places. So I'm going to go through them quickly because I don't want to spend time on the psukim. So if you want to follow it in your Chumash, it's Shemot chapter 13 verse 11 is where you'll find the first ones. So there we've got V'haya ki yaviyacha Hashem el ha'aretz Ezkanani asher nishba alacha levatech u'natan alach. When Hashem brings you to the land of Canaan, which he has sworn to you, V'ha'avarta kol peter rechem la'Hashem, every firstborn belongs to Hashem, V'chol peter sheger behema asher yelecha azacharim la'Hashem, and every male animal that is born belongs to Hashem, V'chol peter chamor tifteh v'seh, and every firstborn donkey has to be redeemed with a sheep. If you don't redeem it, you have to chop its head off. We'll talk about that. And every human bechor, you shall redeem. So we see three areas of bechor. There's kosher animals, There's the chamor is the only non-kosher animal that is a bechor. That's also really, really interesting. It's the only case where we have some kind of kedusha attached to a non-kosher animal, and we'll learn why is the chamor singled out. And there's the human that we still do a pidyon habein for. That's what a pidyon habein is about. Has anybody here had a pidyon habein for their children? Because you've had a pidyon habein. That's about. So there we've got one area of it. In chapter 34, verse 19, Lamed Dalet Yutes, again, Kol Peter Rechem Li, every firstborn is mine, says Hashem. V'chol Miknecha Tizachar, Peter Shor Vaseh, every male ox or sheep. Ufeter Chamor Tifdeh Vaseh, and again we're told, if it's a donkey, you'll redeem it with a lamb. V'im lo tifdeh v'arafto, if you don't, you'll chop off its head. Kol bechor banecha tifdeh v'lo yera'u fanai rekam. Every one of your children that is a bechor, you'll redeem, and you won't see my face empty-handed. In Bamidbar, v'yedaber Hashem el Moshe l'emor, chapter 3, verse 11. V'ani hinei lakachti et ha-levi'im mitoch b'nei Yisrael, tachat kol bechor peterechim b'nei Yisrael. I have taken the levi'im in place of the bechorim. So originally the bechorim were all mine, now I've taken the levi'im as the holy tribe. V'hayu li ha-levi'im. Because when I destroyed every Bechor in Egypt, every Jewish Bechor that I saved became mine. Because that's the nature of when you save somebody that you would otherwise have killed, he owes you his life. I sanctified every Bechor in Israel. They're mine, I am Hashem. That's another area. And then further on in chapter 3, verse 40, count up all the Levim and take the Levim and the animals of the Levim, and Moshe counts it all up, and he gets to the number 273, and Hashem says, take a Levi for every Bechor. And they shall be me, and they shall be mine. And those that are in addition, you have a few more Bechorim than you have Levim, those need to be redeemed with 5 shkalim, the same we do today with the Pidyon HaBein. And you shall give the money to Aaron and his children, which Moshe did. So those are the areas. But what we see clearly is that the area of Bechor affects 3 types of Bechor. Again, we're talking now conceptually. There's a concept called the Bechor. Let's not worry about chopping his head off and what that means and paying back the Kohen. Don't translate it yet into the physical world. Live in the conceptual world. There's this idea called the Bechor. Where does the idea of the Bechor come from? Well, the one place it comes from is coming out of Egypt when the Bechorim were killed. So there's this idea of Hashem who wiped out all the Bechorim, kept the Bechor of the Jews intact and alive, and so the Bechorim have Kedusha. So we've got this idea of the firstborn having Kedusha. That's the idea. Now, what does that mean? How does that translate? Well, if it's a human, the way you deal with that Kedusha is through redemption. If it's an animal, you deal with it by giving it to the Kohen. If it's a donkey, you deal with it by redeeming the donkey with a lamb and replacing the kedusha of the donkey on the lamb, because we can't do anything with a donkey that has kedusha, as we will learn. Now let's go a little bit further onto the next sheet, which should be the Rambam. And what I want to show you with the Rambam is just that the Rambam paskens the laws of Bechor in different places. When we learn the Rambam is a key to the Gemara. To learn the Gemara without parallelly learning the Rambam is not very enlightening. And one of the things that the Rambam does so brilliantly is he classifies. By where he brings the particular halakha, that tells us a lot about where the Rambam classifies it. And classification is the art. That is the most important piece of it. So where does the Rambam classify the laws of Bechor? So the first place is, if you look at the very top there, Rambam Hilchot Bikurim, Perek Aleph. Bikurim are the first fruits that you bring. So the Rambam holds the laws of Bechor are in part like Bikurim. And the Rambam says in the first law, Halacha Aleph, Esrim v'arba matanot nidlu la kohanim v'chulan b'furashim b'torah. There are 24 gifts that the Jewish people have to give the Kohanim, and they're all mentioned explicitly in the Torah. So the two Kohanim used to sit on either side of you in the shul. You've got to, when Mashiach comes, you have to give them lots of gifts. Val kulam nichrata brit l'Aaron, there's a covenant with Aaron for all of them. V'chol kohen she'enu modeh bahen, ein lo chelik bekohanim, ve'en notnin lo matana mehen, and if any kohen who doesn't accept that this is the role of a kohen doesn't get any of these privileges. In halacha gimel, a little further. Shmoni matanot mehen ein ochlin otamakonim ela bemikdash, lifnim michomat ha'azara. There are eight of these gifts that a kohen has to eat inside the Beis HaMikdash. So again, we now concepts, right? There's a concept called Matnas Kohuna, gifts to a kohen. There's a concept called a kohen. There's a concept called the Beis HaMikdash. The kohen has to, for eight of these gifts, he has to come into the Beis HaMikdash and he has to eat them in the Beis HaMikdash. The Chamesh Matanot Enuch Ninotan Ela B'Yerushalayim Lifnim Michomat Ha'ir. There are five of these gifts, don't have to be eaten in the Beis HaMikdash, but they do have to be eaten in Yerushalayim. And then another five you only get in Israel, not outside of Israel. Five you get in both places. And there's one gift you get from the temple, from the Beis HaMikdash itself. So different classifications of gifts, we don't have to worry about them yet. Then in Halacha Hey, the next paragraph, what are the five gifts that you give to a Kohen that can only be eaten in Jerusalem? If you bring a korban shlamim, a certain type of korban, you've got to give the breast and the shoulder to the Kohen. And he can only eat that in Yerushalayim. And the truma that is taken from a korban toda, another type of toda. And what you take off from the ram that a nazir has to bring. Uvechor behemah tohara, and the firstborn of a kosher animal, is also one of the matnos kahuna that he has to eat in Jerusalem, which is why the Rambam classifies the laws of bechor in the section of bikurim, because it's part of matnos kahuna. So what is bikurim about? Bikurim is about giving the first to God. That's really what bikurim, first fruits, first animal, first child. Bikurim is the first of everything we give to Hashem. How do you give something to Hashem? Either you give it as a korban or you give it to the kohanim. And then the kohanim have to treat it with a lot of kedusha. So how do the kohanim treat it with kedusha? They eat it either in Jerusalem or in the temple. Bechor is one of those things. Being a firstborn, it's like bikurim. It's one of the first things you bring. This has nothing to do with the Jews being saved from Egypt, the bechor being saved from Egypt. Do you follow what's going on? We've learned one reason for bechor is I took you out of Egypt, I killed all the bechorim, I didn't kill you, so you're mine. This is independent of that. This is, whatever is first belongs to God. And this is one of the ways we express that. And then he goes down in the next paragraph, chapter 11, paragraph 1, mitzvat aseh lifdot kol ish Yisrael beno shehu bechor li'imo, anybody has a child, which is his firstborn, to the mother, the mother's firstborn, and the mother is Jewish, that's a bechor, has to be redeemed. In the next one, mitzvat aseh lifdot kol adam Yisrael petach hamor b'seh. If you've got a donkey that had a firstborn, then you've got to redeem the donkey with a lamb and give it away. And then the last one you've got, we're not at the end yet. At the bottom of the page, mitzvat aseh lafrish kol petarechem azcharim. Now we're in Hilchot Bechorot. You notice the title here? There's another section in the Rambam called Hilchot Bechorot. And that's in the laws of temple service and sacrifices. So there's one dimension of Bechor, which is first fruits. There is another dimension of Bechor, which is laws of sacrifices. This is part of Avodah. This is part of the practice. And here it's a mitzvah taseh lafrish, and he goes with that in Halakha 1. And then the next one, Bechor Adam, Bechor Chamor, Niftim, and he goes into the details. We'll refer back to this as we get into these passages. Bechor behemat Torah shu balmum, what happens with the Bechor behemat? The Rambam goes through all these cases. And then in Halakha Dalet, on your next page, Halakha Dalet, mitzvah lakdish Bechor behemat Torah, you've got to actually declare a Bechor as a Bechor, v'yomar, and you've got to say, harei ze kodesh, this animal is kodesh, shenema takdish la'ashem elokecha, v'im lo hikdisho, but if you didn't declare it, harei ze mekudash me'elav. It's kodesh in any case. And that is kudushato me'rechem hi, The Bechor is Kodesh from birth, from as it comes out of the womb. That's the only case of Kodesh that is like that. Every other case of Kodesh, you need a human being to make it Kodesh. You Hekdesh, you want to make something Hekdesh, you've got to declare it. You want to make a Korban, you've got to declare that your animal's a Korban. You can't make something Kodesh. You want to make a Sefer Torah holy, you've got to write a Sefer Torah according to the laws, and you've got to give it Kedusha. We have to give things Kedusha. The Rambam says you're supposed to declare that this Bechor is Kodesh, but if you don't, it's Kodesh in any case. It's absolutely unique in that way. It's the only item of Kedusha that is naturally Kodesh. Yeah, it falls into that Zraim section in a way. Isn't that right? It's nature. It's produced. Bechor is produced by nature. And its Kedusha comes from nature. And then there's a piece of the Sefer Achinuch, which we'll go into later on. And he also brings that this is the idea of firstborn fruit, of firstborn and first fruit. But let us spend the few minutes that we've got left going into the starting to look at the Gemara itself. So that you've got in the page that we printed out, that I sent to you. And the area that we're starting is the third chapter, Perek Shlishi on Daf Yutet. And the reason that we're starting with Perek Shlishi is because I want to get you right into dealing with uncertainty. Because to me, that's one of the most important things in our times, is how to deal with uncertainty, because in our times, everything is uncertain. And Halakha, Gemara, is all about uncertainty and how you deal with the uncertainty. And this piece of Gemara gets right into it. How you deal with uncertainty, how you deal with paradox, how you deal with things that aren't black and white. The first thing you'll notice, those of you who are not well-versed in Gemara, will notice the layout of the page. Now, you can get Gemaras that are laid out linearly like a normal book, and deliberately we don't want to do that. There's a reason that it's laid out this way. There are many reasons. The one is it conditions your mind to the idea of circular thinking, or what I call spherical thinking. You start with something in the middle and you move out. Mm-hmm. And this is a graphic manifestation. So when you're learning Gemara, it's always in front of you. You've always got this layout in front of you of a core text, and then Rashi and Tosfos, and then it moves out and it moves out and it moves out, so that your thinking is not linear. And the image of it is very, very powerful. Also, as we'll go through, you'll just see it's also very just very user friendly, because in the case of your photostat, it's the left hand column of Rashi script is Rashi. It's not always the left hand column. On the next page, it'll be the right hand column. The two inner columns are Rashi, and the two outer columns are Tosfos. And we'll learn both Rashi and Tosfos, and you'll see the differences between them and why you need them both. And the Gemara starts with a piece of Mishnah, and that's the way the Gemara is structured. It'll quote a Mishnah, and then it'll go for several pages analyzing the Mishnah. Then it'll quote the next Mishnah, and it'll analyze the Mishnah. And the Mishnah was the embodiment of oral law put together by Rabbi Yehuda Anasi around the year 200, and he put it into those six categories of Zroim and Nashi and Moed and Nashim and Zikin. That was Rabbi Yehuda Anasi, and that's the Mishnah that we have till this day. And the Gemara starts with the Mishnah, and then it moves into the Gemara itself. So here's the case. Mishnah is always case study. But again, it's conceptual case study. Not these cases might never have happened. Sometimes these cases could never happen. It doesn't matter. The Mishnah is talking about a principle that you will discover by working with these relationships, whether or not they've ever happened or not. Halokeach behemah min ha'oved kochavim. You buy an animal from a non-Jew. Non-Jewish farmer, you buy an animal. Ve'eino yodea im bichra. It's a female animal. And you don't know whether this animal has yet had a baby. Im lo bichra. Or maybe it hasn't had a baby. Do you see the uncertainty already? So already the Mishnah starts. What case of uncertainty? If the animal was yours always, was born in your farm, then you know. But you buy an animal that's not a newborn. A newborn animal, the animal is already older, and you don't know whether it's been had a bechor or not. Why is that important for you?
If it's a bechor, give it to the
animal. At the moment you're just buying an animal.
The one if she has a baby.
Yes, if the animal now has a calf, is the next calf a bechor? That becomes important. Do I have to give it to the kohen or not? So what happens if we give it to the kohen? We say, we're in doubt. Let's give it to the kohen in any case. Why wouldn't that work? just be sure. Just give it to the Kohen and you have no problem.
Can't be brought to the temple.
Yeah, it can't be brought to the temple if it isn't a Bechor. Okay, so then we'll just keep it. If there's no proof, if the Kohen has no proof that it's a Bechor, let's just keep it. Now I'm using and eating a Bechor, which I'm not allowed to eat. So there are very severe consequences in not clarifying this doubt. So now I've got an animal in my house and I don't know. And I might have bought a whole herd of them. I might have bought 1,000 animals from a non-Jew. 1,000 cows from a non-Jew. And these cows start having calves. Are any of these cows Bechorot? How would I know? Why can't we just ask the non-Jew?
He doesn't know either.
Or he's going to say, of course they've had calves already. Why would he say that?
You can keep.
Yeah, it's more valuable. The next calf it has can be yours. Mm. So he's a businessman. The non-Jew is a businessman. It doesn't mean anything to him. He doesn't care about Bechor or not Bechor. So you can't. It's unfair to ask him. It's unfair to expect him to tell you the truth. He has no interest in telling you the truth. So you have no way of establishing. So what do you do in a case of a doubt where you have no way of establishing the truth? So again, do you follow that the principle goes far beyond Bechor? This is a principle you face and I face every single day of our lives. There are things we don't know for sure. What do we do? And you can't ask somebody because either they won't tell you the truth or you can't assume they'll tell you the truth or they also don't know. There isn't information. And you go and you buy something at a store and you say, is this really good? Is this really a good computer? It's an unfair question to ask the salesman. So how are you going to find out? So you go online, some say yes, some say no. We're dealing with it all the time.
Can you ask for documentation, show me the birth certificate of this calf versus...
Yeah, they don't have birth certificates. Hard enough to get human birth certificates sometimes. To go and get a cow's birth certificate, not going to happen. So now we have different views. Rabbi Yishmael Omer, Rabbi Yishmael says the following. Eiz bat shnata, if the goat is less than a year, vaday lekohen, the next baby, the next calf, will belong to the Kohen for sure. Why?
Can't have a baby
because the goat couldn't have had a calf before that. Okay, so that's relatively easy. Mikan ve'elach, what happens if the goat is more than 1 year old? Sofik. That's a doubt. So Rabbi Shmuel is saying it's not all doubts. Let's just clarify what is doubt, what isn't. Firstly, you can take out those that are less than, any goats that are less than a year old, you can take them aside because they're not in doubt. We know what they are. Rachel, a lamb, bat shtayim, if she's 2 years old, vaday lekohen, she hasn't had a baby yet, she hasn't had a calf yet. Mikan ve'elach, sofik, further than that is a doubt. Para v'chamor, if it's a donkey or a cow, benot shalosh, vaday lekohen, mikan ve'elach, sofik. Up until 3 years, you can assume that it hasn't had a baby and the next baby is a kohen. But if the animal is more than 3 years old, you don't know.
The mission is assuming you can age these animals correctly, right?
Yes, assuming you can, which they didn't seem to have a problem with, interestingly. That they figured that they were able to do that, right. Mm-hmm. Whether they did that by asking, because that the non-Jewish farmer has no reason to lie about. So whether it's done by asking the farmer or whether they had some more scientific way of doing it, I'm not sure, but that didn't seem to be a problem to them. Correct. Omer lo Rabbi Akiva, ilu bivlad bilvad ha-behema nifteret kidvarecha. If it was just about a calf, having a calf, then you would be right. Ela amru, but the problem is that we've learned. Siman ha-vlad bivahema daka tinuf. There are different points at which an animal is considered to have given birth. So what happens if the animal has a miscarriage? Is the next animal a bechor or isn't it? And what do you call a miscarriage? What point is it a miscarriage? So halacha defines that too. And says in the case of a behema daka is a sheep or a goat. Tinuf. All you need from there is certain discharge that the female animal produces. And from that you can see that she's had a miscarriage. And from there on, the next animal is not a bechor. Uvegasa, shilya. And in the case of a cow, a big animal, it's actually the sac, what's it called? The embryonic sac.
The
shilya. Yes, correct. Placenta. It would be actually the placenta, uvisha, shafir, vishilya, and with a human being, It is shvir and shuliyatz, the placenta, and what would be the other one? The embryonic sac, I think it is. So it's not so simple that if it's 2 years old, 3 years old, because the animal could have got pregnant and had a miscarriage, and how would you know? So says Rabbi Akiva Zeh HaKlal, this is what's important for us. This is the principle. There's a principle here. Kol sheyadua shebichra ein kan lekohen klum. If you know that she's had a child before, if you have a way of knowing that this animal gave birth before you bought it, the kohen has no claim. V'chol shelo bichra, if you have no way of knowing that, hareze lekohen, the next child belongs to the kohen. So this, there's a mandatory issue here. Who does the next child belong to? Who does the next calf belong to? Unless you know that there's been a birth before, it doesn't belong to the kohen. It belongs to the kohen. Ve'im safek, and if you just don't know, you have no way of knowing, ye achil b'mumo labalim, then we leave it to get a mum. A mum means it gets an imperfection. Just some, it gets damaged, it hurts itself, whatever. It gets an imperfection, and at that point, the owner is allowed to eat it. So you do nothing with it, you let it roam around, and you wait till it gets a mum. You mark it, this is the one, the doubt one, the doubtful one. It gets a mum, and at that point, you can eat it. Now, when we get into the Gemara is going to start analyzing, well, what about going after majority? What about looking at what's normal? What about looking at who has to bring the owners on, who is the owners of proof? The Gemara is getting into all the various mechanisms we use to clarify doubt. Here we've just got a case. There's an idea of doubt. You're buying an animal. It's from a non-Jew. You don't know. We've established, if you do know, either because of nature or because of fact, that will clarify it for us. Where you don't know, it's a genuine doubt, and it has to be treated as a doubt. We will label it as a doubt. This is a safek bechor. So in halacha, often we have those labels, a safek bechor, and it has certain halachot. For a real bechor, you've got to give it to the kohen. The kohen has to slaughter it in the temple, and so on. For something that isn't a bechor, you can eat yourself. It's not a problem. A safek bechor is a different. It's a third category. A safek bechor is a bechor. You don't know. You don't know whether it's a bechor or not. And you can't know, and it has to be left to become imperfect, and then it can be eaten by the owner.
So a bechor with a mum is given to a kohen.
A proper bechor with a mum is given to the kohen still. A safek bechor is not.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's one of the differences between a safek bechor and a real bechor. So we're going to next week we will review the Mishnah. We'll get to know the Mishnah well. We'll analyze the Mishnah a little bit and go into the Gemara. We'll look at Rashi. And we're going to look at Tosfot, because one of the things Tosfot is going to go into is whether the fact that nowadays, apparently, animals can have their calves at less than 3 years old. So that's an interesting case where science contradicts the Torah. What do we do? So now what happens if you buy an animal that is 3 years old? Can you apply the principle of the Mishnah? Definitely not. The next one's definitely a Bechor, because this cow couldn't have had a calf earlier. Mishnah says so. It's clear. Yeah, but science says it's not true. Not nowadays.
Mm-hmm.
What do we do with that? So Tosfos goes into that. But it's not only a Tosfot here. It's a Tosfot in Avodah Zarah as well. There's a piece in Chulin, which you'll have in the source sheets that I've given you. So that's where we start. As I said to you, it's not linear. It's hyperlinked. You've got to actually pull, the same as with the psukim, do you see the verses we pulled from different parts of the Chumash? You want to look at, there's not a section of the Chumash the way all the Bechor stuff is in one drawer. Isn't there? They're tagged. Bechor is tagged, and you pull all the Bechor out, and now you've got the Bechor pieces. The same in the Gemara. We're dealing with a case of where science and Torah are in conflict. There's not one section that deals with that. There's not one Besechta. There's not one Perek that deals with that. There are pieces of Gemara all over the place. And one of the mechanisms we use to bring that together so that we can look at it all is Tosfot. That's why Tosfot is so important. Some people don't learn Tosfot, they just learn Rashi. Yeah, but then what are you learning? You're just learning what's in front of you. And you'll see some interesting things. If you look at Tosfot, the top Tosfot, that's the right-hand Rashi script paragraph, the very top one. Do you see in brackets there, there's an Ayin Zayin Daf Chaf Dalet, which is Avodah Zarah Daf Chaf Dalet. Can you see that in the middle?
Yeah.
Avodah Zarah, which means Tosfos is going to refer us to another Gemara in Avodah Zarah, another Masechta. And Tosfos is telling us, you've got to see that text as well. you can't learn this text without seeing that text because they're hyperlinked. They don't happen to be in the same page. It's like saying when you're on with your Google emails, this email was sent, you know, on such and such a date, and that email was sent a year before. There's no way I can put them together. Of course you can. You can put them together, and then you've got them all together. That's what we're doing with Gemara all the time. We're bringing them together. You'll also see a piece. Do you notice on the left-hand side, they're all different things on the very left-hand side, but about the middle of the page, there's a thing called Gilayon HaShas. Do you see that?
Mm-hmm.
Gilayon HaShas is written by Rabbi Akiva Eger. When Rabbi Akiva Eger was learning Gemara, he made little notes on the sides of his Gemara, and this is one of his, we've got those notes. And what does he say there? Ein Tosfos Chulin Daf Mem Zayin Amud Aleph. Look at a Tosfos in Chulin. You can't, because this is not complete. So you need, our Tosfos brings the Tosfos from Avodah Zorah, and Rabbi Kivek says, oh, don't forget the Tosfos in Chulin as well, because that will give you a complete picture of how to deal with this. And that's how Gemara works. And that's why, as I say again, like with Daf Hayomi, you just go through the page. But you can't deal with the concepts, because the concepts aren't all on one page. When you're dealing with a page, the concepts are spread out, and you've got to bring them, and you bring them together. And that's why for the Western mind, that's a little difficult. Who knows Chulin? And how am I supposed to know that? And where would I know that? Well, you wouldn't know it. You'd have Tosfos. And you'll find your way there. Like when you're working on the internet, you find your way there. Gemara works the same way. You look at the Tosfos. You look up Avodah Zorah. Avodah Zorah will bring the Gemara in Chulin, the Rabbi Kivega. There'll be a thread. But you've got to follow the thread and come back to where you are to get the complete picture. So what we're going to be looking at is not so much a man buys an animal from a non-Jew, is the calf a bechor or not. We're looking at dealing with doubt, dealing with uncertainty. We're dealing with to what extent you can rely on nature to clarify an uncertainty. Can you make assumptions based on nature? What happens if the assumptions based on nature conflict with assumptions in the Gemara itself? And how do we deal with it? That's going to be the first topic that we're going to be dealing with for the next few weeks. And we'll only go, you know, a few lines further than this. For several weeks, we probably won't go a whole lot further than this, but we'll become much more familiar with it as we do. Okay, so the, a brief...